Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Glad you could be with us. Our special guest today is Josh Keltzer, who's in several senior national security positions across the Biden and Obama administrations, and those included, he was deputy legal advisor to the White House National Security Council and senior director for counterterrorism. One of the things we're going to ask him about is this extraordinary testimony today in the House Homeland Security Committee, where a senior FBI official claimed that the number one domestic threat, the most immediate threat facing America today, is coming from Antifa. Now, Mike, Karen, you heard this testimony. What do you make of it?
I loved the questions from Congressman Benny Thompson, the ranking Democrat on the committee. Where is Antifa located? How many members does it have? And the FBI witness, whose name, by the way, was Michael Glashine, this operations director for the FBI National Security Branch, was completely clueless. He had no idea how to answer the question. All he could say is, well, our investigations are active and ongoing.
Yeah. We've all heard testimony from FBI, CIA, et cetera, officials in Congress for years when they ask about ISIS, right? Or Al-Qaeda. Yeah. And they did have trouble identifying Al-Qaeda in the beginning. They didn't know much about it.
Yeah.
But they could say, well, we think this group is headquartered here, you know, it's Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, and how many people?
Well, they knew
so
who
on.
Its leaders were. They knew approximately how many people. They could identify certain terrorist acts that Al-Qaeda members had committed.
But you guys, but, you know, there's also something to be said about what's happened with the word terrorism since the attacks of 9/11. And how it's morphed and been used to identify, just as a throwaway term, these are terrorists. In addition to all of the terrorist groups that we've known and identified and that are real threats to national security and global security, there's also been this sense that it's a sort of inchoate category that we don't really want to define because we want to be able to expand it to who we need to expand it to. And this has been a worry, you know, at least for the past decade. And I think you're seeing it on Antifa, and who knows what other agendas it will be applied to in future days. And so I see this as a worrisome trend. And by the way, one that doesn't necessarily help identify terrorists because it doesn't have those definitional realities, who, what, when, and where, and why.
Exactly.
By the way, one of the many unanswered questions here is just what they know about who these suspected drug smugglers are, right? I mean, Hegseth says in the case of the September 2nd strike, which had the sort of the double strike to kill the two survivors from the first strike, that we knew the identity of all 11 of those people on the boat. Yet, a few weeks later, when there are two survivors on another boat that they killed, they send them back. They don't kill them. So if these people are dangerous terrorists, why didn't they kill those people? Or, you know, are they killing people who are not dangerous terrorists? And one other point that has been made but can't be made enough, when the Coast Guard interdicts drug boats in the Caribbean, suspected drug boats in the Caribbean, 1/4 of the time, there are no drugs on the boat. The intelligence is wrong. So the intelligence is not perfect in this area, this arena, yet we are relying on the intelligence to kill people.
Yeah, and that's been pointed out a lot in the last couple of weeks. When you just kill these people, you're depriving yourself of possible sources. You know, you arrest these people and turn them. They want to reduce their sentences, and so they squeal. Or supposedly.
That's how you get more intelligence.
That's how it works.
Right.
But is your point...
It's called human.
Is your point... So the point here is that these drug attacks are part of a strategy to ramp up this pre-war state with Venezuela. And right? It's not just about, we're worried about the law enforcement issues. We know it's about something else, whether it's about Maduro, right. Whether it's about oil. And so you can't lose sight of that and just go their way and say, let's focus just on these boats and what the issues are, because what they're really trying to do is way beyond what we're talking about.
We don't know. And Trump may not even know what he's talking about. I mean, what's the plan for Venezuela?
All I can say is, you know, when the Bush administration invaded Iraq, it went to great pains to say that this was not to seize the oil fields. It was not about oil, right? It was about WMD and the terrorist threats and, you know, all of which was, you know, obviously completely dead wrong, but that was their justification. In this case, you know, they don't even hide the fact that it's about oil. They seize an oil tanker, right? A major oil tanker. I think one of the more interesting little aspects of that is that, you know, it's unclear where this oil tanker was headed, but there are reports in the Washington Post. They quoted sources saying that it was believed to be Cuba. Mike McCall, on the Republican on House Homeland Security, repeated that during the hearing today. If that's the case, I wonder if that wasn't a motivator for certainly Secretary of State Rubio, who might see this as a double bank shot to get rid of Maduro and help bring down the communist regime in Cuba. But something to think about.
If they would be the motivation or the rationales for attacking, pressuring Venezuela seem to change every day, almost every hour. So who knows what their final game plan is. Actually, we're going to be running a piece shortly comparing the run-up to whatever is going to happen in Venezuela with what went on with Panama in 1989. A lot of similarities there. Anyway, to discuss this all, we're bringing on Josh Kelzer, who, as I said, he has done just about everything you can do as a career national security official, and we're really eagerly awaiting his views. So without further ado, let's get to that. Josh Kelzer, welcome to Spy Talk. Your resume is so sparkling that it could take me an hour to list all the senior positions you've held in the national security realm across multiple Democratic administrations. But I'll just name a couple of them, including you were deputy legal advisor to the White House National Security Council and later senior director for counterterrorism. You have homeland security portfolios in your background. And we just happened to have an incident that happened today that we want to ask you about, given your particular background, and that is the testimony of a senior FBI official at the Homeland Security Committee in the House today, in which he posited that Antifa was the most immediate violent threat to America today. Let's take a listen.
We're trying to get the information. You say Antifa is a terrorist organization. Tell us, as a committee, how did you come to that? where do they exist? How many members do they have in the United States as of right now?
Well, that's very fluid. It's ongoing for us to understand that. The same, no different than Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
No, I don't want you. I'll ask one question, sir. I just want you to tell us. If you said Antifa is the number one domestic terrorist organization operating in the United States, I just need to know where they are, how many people. I don't want a name. I don't want anything like that. Just how many people have you identified with the FBI that Antifa is made of?
Well, the investigations are active.
So you wouldn't come to this committee and say something you can't prove. I know. I know you wouldn't do that. But you did.
Josh, what's going on here?
Jeff, first, thanks for letting me join you all for the conversation. I've been looking forward to it. And yeah, I do think this back and forth on the Hill today picks up on an administration push to describe and characterize Antifa in a way that kind of fits into a counterterrorism set of legal authorities, a counterterrorism regime that it may not be a natural fit for. You know, the kind of most notable element of this in recent months, I think, was when the president issued an executive order designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization. And that is not a statutorily created category. It's not a foreign terrorist organization. It's not a specially designated global terrorist. Those are things with groundings in statute. This is a kind of a phrase attached to this entity or movement or whatever the right characterization is. At the same time, and labeling anything with that kind of term carries a stigmatic effect. It has consequences, even if they're not direct legal ones.
And from your long experience at the highest rungs of the national security world in Washington, you must imagine that this had to be excruciating testimony for this long-time FBI official. I mean, these guys do not have a habit of going to the Hill and making up stuff in front of people who know better than he knows better. What do you think?
Like, I do think you see kind of law enforcement officials. I don't know this individual personally, but I do see law enforcement officials who are having to grapple with kind of a push to apply things known in one context, established in certain ways, to a context that they appear, you know, a pretty tough fit for. At the same time, you're a law enforcement official, you have an executive order issued by the president, then you have a national security presidential memorandum, NSPM 7, that further directs kind of work in what this administration is characterizing as its approach to countering domestic terrorism. And it's hard, I think, to take traditionally understood elements, regimes, authorities, and understand exactly how this administration wants them.
So Josh, you helped draft the Biden administration's domestic violent extremism strategy. Was Antifa on your radar screen when you're doing that? Was this one of the groups that you saw as being a threat to violence domestically in the United States?
Well, when we launched that review, we quite deliberately wanted to make sure that we were developing a strategy responsive to threats as characterized by the professionals, the experts, and the law enforcement.
Was Antifa one of those threats that those professionals flagged to you?
It was not, because you can look in it. You can go back to that document, which is still sitting available online, and you can look at the executive summary of the assessment, the threat assessment, essentially, that was provided to us. Now, that threat assessment talks about a range of categories, because domestic terrorism can have ideologies left, right, center, off the political spectrum, valence of various types. But I don't think you will see among the kind of categories named there Antifa. You will instead see a kind of rack and stack of categories: racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, anti-government and militia.
But Antifa itself was not even on your radar as a potential domestic threat right up until you were in the White House, until January of this year. Through January of this year, Was there any threat assessment you saw or threat flagging you saw suggesting that Antifa was involved in violent attacks inside the United States?
I want to swear to what I saw or didn't see in particular assessments, but I'll say this. We approached domestic terrorism on the teams I worked with as being fundamentally two things. One, agnostic as to the ideology that motivated an individual or a group of individuals. What matters in our country under our laws is that whatever your frustrations, whatever your dislike of a legislature, a judge, whatever, what you can't do is turn violent. And that guided our work. And the second thing.
So in your professional opinion, is Antifa a violent threat inside the United States?
I'm not laser focused on what Antifa is or isn't. I'm laser focused on what it means to think about countering domestic terrorism.
But as you think about it, do you think about Antifa as something that needs to be thwarted and investigated?
I guess what I'm saying, Mike, is I don't care if someone calls themselves Antifa, if they call themselves violent white supremacists, or they call themselves whatever. Here's what they can't do. They cannot turn violent with their political or ideological worldview.
One other question about the testimony this morning. Joe Kent, who's now the NCTC, National Counterterrorism Director, said that they've recently done an analysis that has concluded that 18,000 terrorists or suspected terrorists were let into the United States during the Biden administration years. What do you make of that number? Is that a number that makes any sense to you? Or were you aware that 18,000 terrorists were coming into the country on your watch?
Definitely not a number that resonates with either my experience or my lived sense of how all sorts of entries, right? All sorts of ways in which people come into this country under visa programs, under travel, all sorts of things. But in all of them, there's vetting and screening done to try to make sure that people cross our borders as they need to for commerce, for studies, for scientific exchanges, or to actually migrate here, but that they don't pose a threat to American communities. And vetting and screening happens in multi-layered ways. It differs exactly in what databases are checked depending on the legal regime through which someone's coming. But the bottom line is people are vetted and screened to try to ensure that as people need to cross our borders, they also don't threaten American communities.
Well, did you discover terrorists or suspected terrorists coming into the country during that time? And if so, about how many?
You know, it is overwhelmingly the case that those who have engaged in or even attempted to engage in terrorist activity over the past couple of decades, 2.5 decades almost since 9/11, radicalized on U.S. soil. This is not my invention. This is the findings of the U.S. government, but also of outside researchers and academics, that people who've done the unacceptable, turned violent with their beliefs, motivated by ISIS, motivated by some ideology more domestic in nature or whatever it might be, they tend to not fit that paradigm that was brutally experienced on 9/11 of radicalizing abroad and entering with a deliberate plot and intent to engage in terrorist violence on U.S. soil. That would describe the 9/11 hijackers, of course, but instead be more of the type that was experienced to tragic effect somewhere like the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, where you have somebody on U.S. soil radicalizes while on U.S. soil and then does something to it.
I wanted to turn the conversation a little bit towards more of the global national security environment. And I'm sure you read the national security strategy that just came out, which I think was a surprise to all of us compared to prior national security strategies. And in particular, one of the things that struck me was the portrayal of our relationship with China. And this impacts something you've been working on and writing about recently, which is artificial intelligence. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, following the National Security Act, President Trump announced that he's changing the Biden strategy on bans of certain kinds of chips to China. And all of a sudden, NVIDIA can share their H200s with China, which I think is scared a lot of people in the intelligence world and elsewhere. And I wondered if you could just talk about, did this surprise you? What do you think that the cost is potentially to national security? And how should we think about this?
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real debate here, and it's a debate that seems to be sort of trending in one direction. You know, I think the argument made by many in the Biden administration and by some still, I think, within the executive branch on the Hill and beyond, is that for the most sophisticated AI technologies and that which makes AI technology possible, something like the chips and semiconductors, for the most sophisticated edge, there's real national security value in keeping that out of the hands of a country like China that obviously poses something of a threat or at least riflery and potential threat to U.S. interests. Now, the other side of the debate, which seems to be carrying the day more and more within the executive branch, at least, says that it's good for U.S. economics. And I suppose they would even say for U.S. national security to essentially have U.S. tech corner of the global market, maybe even including within China itself. And that is the argument that seems to have led to the administration's own switch on a also sophisticated, but not as sophisticated form of chip that were the H2Os or H20s that were initially not allowed to be sold and then allowed to be sold under the administration. And now for this new permission, which is about six times as powerful a chip. So it seems like the debate is leaning in that direction within the executive branch, despite language in the national security strategy that maintains a posture towards China of some skepticism and concern on national security grounds.
So what can this mean in terms of reducing our security parameters? What actually can happen? Is it just, you know, a matter of stealing secrets, you know, of that are industrial secrets? Is it a matter of potential espionage? What are the consequences as you see it?
I think those who would argue against this sort of move would say all of the above. In other words, AI technology is so powerful now, and it will only get better, that the kind of lead the U.S. has vis-a-vis China is one to be maximized rather than allowed to kind of wash away more swiftly than it might otherwise. In other words, for weapons design, for technological sophistication, for, as you point out, Karen, catching and identifying spies by seeking out patterns that would otherwise be missed in travel or activities or communications, the potential is extraordinary. And I think the national security argument against is that better to let the most sophisticated chips be utilized in U.S. hands for as long as possible. Global rivals will catch up, but make the most of the time one has. Again, the counterargument to that is it may serve the interests of the U.S. to corner the global market with its stack rather than, at least the argument goes, Chinese developers' rival technologies. Others will then get booked on, essentially.
You know, I want to circle back to this national security strategy that the administration has proclaimed and has remarked upon in recent days. What strikes me here is the gulf between the intelligence collection by the professionals, by the agencies who identify, let's say, for starters, China and Russia as our major challenges in national security policy. And administration comes out and says, oh, no. It's really the eclipse of European civilization, et cetera, et cetera. Hardly mention of China and Russia. Have you, in your long and deep and high-level experience in the government, have you ever seen such a gap between the available intelligence from the professionals and the decision-making by officials? Have you ever witnessed anything like that in your time in government?
Now, I mean, this was definitely the element of the national security strategy that I think surprised people the most and got their attention. The idea, you know, there's obviously been some tension between the Trump administration and Europe, a tension over things like what a settlement of the Russia-Ukraine conflict might look like and what would be a reasonable set of terms for that and what might happen to the immobilized Russian assets, all sorts of things that have created tension in the past 11 months or so of the second Trump administration. I think what's new and notable and rightly got people's attention to the national security strategy was kind of a broader conjuring of Europe as posing a threat given its kind of political and cultural orientation, at least as portrayed in that strategy. And in terms of my lived experience, to go to your question, Jeff, I mean, we certainly relied heavily on European partners and the administrations I've been part of for a whole range of things, intelligence sharing, cooperation on counterproliferation, getting our Americans held hostage and wrongfully detained abroad home, where towards the end of the Biden administration, key European countries made some pretty big sacrifices, folks they were willing to release from their custody, Russian, that is, so that we could get our Americans home, as well as some others out of Russian custody. And so it is certainly my lived experience has been one of pretty close partnership and a lot of overlapping and common interests.
So just to put a period on this subject, you've never had the experience where been in the room where senior intelligence officials, and actually you're part of the intelligence community yourself, have laid out a scenario for the president or his top officials and said, these are the facts. And the president, the two presidents he served, said, well, I'm going to do something anyway. Have you had anything like that kind of experience?
No, I mean, I do think that intelligence officials tend to garner a lot of respect in the room, and their conjuring of what is or isn't a threat tends to be taken very serious. Now, often, you know, they are themselves making probabilistic assessments. That's the nature of the business of trying to ferret out the unknown and make it at least projectable in odds that one can assess. But I don't think that's what's really driving this strategy. And in some ways, I think the strategy says that it's something else driving, and it's talking about Europe in kind of political and cultural terms that at least the administration is portraying as somehow threatening to U.S. interests.
And they're just making it up.
They're not reacting to a sort of threat assessment in a traditional sense. They're portraying the European direction as a threat to the United States. Not the view of administrations I served with, and not kind of a lived experience working with Europeans. But it's the way they've characterized it in their doc.
Speaking of making it up, what about because I think it's really important. Like, how much can you make up, and where does the information come from?
Where does it stop?
One of the things we've been talking about lately on the podcast a lot is the Venezuelan Caribbean attacks. And, you know, we're told that there's information that there are drug dealers, drug smugglers, et cetera, and that's what constitutes these acts, you know. And it's almost like a counterpart to the Antifa, right? Like, just sort of, is this real? Is this not real? Well, one of the things that you've, and this is a big question, so answer it however you want, but one of the things you've written about lately, I guess in the Yale Journal of International Law, was about the uses of AI for both getting information and other things, right? And what I was really interested in is your notion of accountability when AI produces wrong information and you end up attacking, saying, oh, AI gave us that information. And where does the buck stop is really what I'm asking. And I'm sort of curious, have you thought about this within the context of the Venezuelan boat attacks? And how do you think about that?
I do think this question of accountability in the age of AI is, at least I find it fascinating. I hope others do as well. And, you know, our whole body of law of armed conflict is premised on the notion that if you meet a certain threshold of bad activity, foreknowledge, mens rea, et cetera, someone is accountable. Now, figuring out who's accountable, even just figuring out the facts to inform that, can be hard, but someone's accountable. And I think what can be tempting about AI, because it seems to do so much on its own, so to speak, is to point to it and say, well, the tech is what's responsible for the errant result here, or again, as it will be increasingly used in the context of armed conflict for taking human life, maybe even taking civilian life. And part of the argument that I'm trying to make in that piece is that it can't be that accountability just evaporates. That doesn't serve the purposes of the law of armed conflict. I also don't think it's the right way to think about this technology. As sophisticated as it is, someone has trained it. Someone has maybe augmented that training, including specifically for military purposes. Someone has decided it should be embedded in a weapon or a weapon system a certain way. Someone has approved its particular deployment or use. And if that ends up with the sort of thing that then looks like a law of armed conflict violation, then those are the places to look for accountability rather than saying, the tech did it. And certainly holding the tech itself accountable, I don't think makes a lot of sense. Because what does that mean? What does it mean to throw an AI model in jail or to fine it? So it's harder maybe to discern which human made the mistake. But the case I want to make is we can't just have accountability evaporate. So that would be a real setback to centuries, really, of trying to move towards greater low act.
So, Josh, leaving aside the AI part of this, you're a scholar on the laws of war. When you look at these boat strikes that the military is conducting, they seem to be predicated on the idea that if they're suspected drug smugglers, in this case, the drug smugglers are narco-terrorists, and therefore, under the laws of war, they are legitimate targets. Is that how you read legal scholarship on this issue?
Yeah, part of what's so hard to know here is that there isn't a lot of clear articulation. In other words, we know there was an Office of Legal Counsel memorandum, but we haven't been able to benefit as a public from reading it. We know there have been congressional briefings, but they have not been ones that any of the four of us has been in the room for. I will say I think one important distinction to make, and it's important for listeners, I think it's been at times kind of modeled in this conversation, is that designations like foreign terrorist organization designation, which has been applied to some of the cartels, indeed was from the earliest days of this administration, is not the same as authorization for use of force. I think even some of the media reporting on conversations within the administration have suggested some confusion about that. And I do think it would, especially given the level of congressional and public interest, I think we'll probably see more from the administration as to how they're actually thinking about domestic legal justifications, international legal justifications. But one thing that's clear is just designating an entity as an FTO, SDGT, or any other sort of designation that might apply to a cartel, like a transnational criminal organization designation, is not the same as determining as a domestic.
So in this case, there is no authorization to use military force against drug boats in the Caribbean or the Pacific. When you were advising on signature strikes in Pakistan, you at least had that. You had an authorization to use military force going back to the days after 9/11. In this case, there isn't. In that case, in your view, if there is no congressional authorization, are these extrajudicial killings?
Without getting into any of the particulars of the past you mentioned, I think you're right that even the administration says they're not operating under a statutory basis here. They're saying, look at the president.
And so therefore, what?
Yeah, so they're saying there's an argument to be made, but we haven't seen the argument that under the president's Article II authority, which OLC has traditionally applied a two-part test to, one piece is there an articulable national interest in using force in this context? And two, does the use of force and anticipated reaction to it rise to the level of war in the constitutional sense? And I gather, but I don't know because I haven't been able to read the OLC memo, that the administration was able to satisfy itself to answer yes on both of those fronts. But how it got to yes on both of those, I think would be of interest to all of us to know. I do suspect we will see more from them. That would still leave, even if they got to yes on both of those, an open question on the international law front.
In any event, the real drug threat to America is fentanyl coming up from Mexico. Made with Chinese precursor chemicals. Now, I had some talks with DEA people back during the Obama administration who told me on very deep background from Beijing that they had some success talking with their Chinese counterparts, of cracking down on the fentanyl manufacturing process. But it was very, very tentative. In your experience, the Chinese, I know it's a, even we could say that give the Chinese some credibility for saying it's a really difficult industry to crack down on these various precursor chemicals and so on, even if they had a great will to do so. What was your experience? Did you get a piece of that action talking with the Chinese about fentanyl precursor chemicals and the Mexicans about cracking down on it?
I think it's such an important point because to zoom out and say, to stipulate to the fact that the fentanyl threat and the cocaine threat and other, but the fentanyl one in terms of numbers is the data say it's the biggest. We all stipulate to the fact that they are horrific threats to Americans. They're taking American lives in kind of astounding numbers. When the Biden administration came into office, those numbers were on the rise month to month. And by the end of the Biden administration, they were falling month to month. Now, they're still far larger than anyone would want to see, but they didn't just fall by coincidence. They fell because of a really multifaceted effort, partly on the demand side, but partly on the supply side, to try to treat this as the national security threat to Americans that I do think it is. And more importantly, the administration I served in took it to be. And that included, as you're emphasizing, going at the question of the Chinese precursor chemicals, because those were moving to the cartels in a way that made possible the production at such an appalling and remarkable scale. And by the end of the Biden administration, you saw China taking meaningful steps, not cure-all steps, not a whole that one might want of them, but meaningful steps to crack down on those entities within their own country's borders because of the pressure they received from the Biden administration and increasingly from other governments as well, because this is not just a U.S. problem. And the cartels are not just a U.S. problem. These cartels are at this point active in dozens of countries around the world. The fentanyl numbers in Europe and elsewhere have gone up. So it's not just the U.S. looking to Beijing and saying, what's going on? How can these precursor chemicals flow to this greater degree to cartels that are then using them to make products that kill our citizens? It was other countries as well. So whatever is happening with respect to you know, use of force, I certainly hope that those sorts of efforts, which seem to show meaningful, make a meaningful dent, at least, in a really big problem, are continuing. I don't have a sense if they are.
Josh, have you noticed that there's a way in which they're trying to fit this conversation about the Caribbean, but also a couple of other things, into a terrorist language, a counter-terrorist language? So, for example, what we think might be in the OLC memo and other justifications for this policy is not about drugs coming to the United States, but about the proceeds from the drugs being used to inspire violence in the United States. And I noticed that on the ship that was taken this week by the United States, right, that the Skipper, I think it's called, that one of the things they said was that they thought they were going to use the proceeds from the oil for Hezbollah and the Al-Quds force. So I'm just wondering if you see this kind of use of what may, you know, old actually, you know, threads of the terrorism language being used. And if you think that that is something that we can counter with facts, or that it's, you know, a way of trying to get laws that are on the books to try to get them to apply, counterterrorism laws to apply to this.
That's the framing being brought to bear, although it's in part the framing because that has been such a focus of national security authorities and, frankly, use of force for our country for the past 2.5 decades. Now, I think that's with some justification because that was a major threat, you know, to Americans, and one that has not fully gone away despite a lot of effort being put into it. But I think in some ways, as people of a certain leadership level in government have thought about use of force, have thought about the authorities associated with it, have thought about how one frames national security challenges, that is one that has been not the only, but certainly a dominant streak over the past 2.5 decades. And I do think that one of the pivots that the first Trump administration seemed deliberately to try to make, that the Biden administration continued and that now is being rolled back a bit, is a pivot to what Trump one called great power competition, whatever label you want to put on it. It was a explicit, I'd say, effort to reorient our national security emphasis, focus, apparatus, resources, bandwidth on problems beyond counterterrorism, such as the threat that China poses in Asia and potentially beyond. And of course, the threat that the Russia poses, especially once it went ahead and committed further aggression and invaded its sovereign neighbor. So it is interesting, I think, to see kind of the comeback of counterterrorism or counterterrorism framing when you've had a couple of administrations now really try to pivot towards a global reality that doesn't have terrorist threats gone. No one would say that. But that has other things surging, not to mention transnational threats like the global pandemic that knocked us all backwards a half decade ago, climate change, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
On that note, I have asked ODNI about Joe Kent's testimony I referred to earlier about 18,000 terrorists, whether they have reclassified drug smugglers or suspected drug smugglers as terrorists to reach that rather large number. But I have another question for you, Josh. I don't know if you had a chance to read the really lengthy, detailed New York Times investigation into how the Biden White House, which you served in, was really slow to recognize just how many people were pouring across the border and didn't want to take steps that might let them be criticized for repeating Trump-era policies. And as a result, basically, allowed or failed to take action that allowed, you know, an extraordinary number of undocumented migrants to cross the border. You were there at the time when all this was coming down. Was the New York Times right? And were your colleagues too slow? Did they drop the ball on recognizing the migrant threat at the border?
Well, I'll confess that I've not read the piece, but I will say this. You know, I think the president himself, the administration more broadly, had a fundamental notion that those who could enter through orderly programs, the types that we worked hard to create, such as for Ukrainians, for Afghans, and then for others in the region like Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, that there was a way to bring order, including the sort of vetting and screening we were talking about before, to the process so that by the end, you had very low numbers of unlawful crossings or crossings without some visa or otherwise lawful basis for at least entering. I also think that that's kind of what Americans want when you look at polling, and I'm not a political specialist, but when you look at polling on this issue that has been so central to American politics, discourse, debate for however long now, I think no American has sort of a particular number of unlawful encounters at the border that they're imagining as the optimal. Nor do they have a number of particular types of...
It can be argued that this is what cost Kamala Harris the election, that it was the concern about the flood of migrants crossing the border, and especially when Governors Abbott and DeSantis started busing them up to cities with Democratic mayors in New York and Washington and elsewhere, that it really hit home. And there was grievous political damage done as a result of this. And it seems like, the people in the leadership at the White House were just clueless about how this was going to play out. The damage was done in that first year when hundreds of thousands crossed the border.
Yes, what I'm saying is I'm not a political guru, but what I'm saying is I think what people want to see is an orderly approach.
That's not what they saw in 2020.
I think by the end, you saw numbers that achieved that. I also think you saw a candidate in Donald Trump who, and again, his own party has said this, thwarted what was otherwise going to be landmark legislation moving forward to do what both parties have said for a while they wanted to do, which is legislate in an area where statutes are too old, where resources are too few, and where there was a deal that had been carefully struck by folks on the Hill of both parties and by the White House. So I do think that there is a fundamental desire for Americans not to see unkindness, and also not to see openness, but to see something in the middle that's orderly. And what that is going to take over the long haul is actual hard work of updating our laws. That's work that was being done, but it got thwarted in the middle.
And you saw this thing that happened just in the couple days ago about, you know, 5 years scrutiny for social media for people who come in as tourists. I mean, this seems to me like a fundamental transformation of how we think about, for lack of a better word, others, foreigners, et cetera. And I think I see this an extension of the immigration policy and the immigration ideas that this administration has brought to the table. Do you see a connection between those two, or do you think they're just completely other? I mean, and you know what I'm talking about with the social media, right? Yeah.
I've seen it. I want to dig into it more. My recollection is that there was, I think during the first Trump administration, a push for looking at kind of social media, open social media of a visa applicants. Now the extension would be to ESTA applicants. You know, it's something that admittedly the Biden administration did not reverse with respect to visa applicants. I want to understand more what it relates to, what its scope is. But I think, Karen, you're asking a question that in some ways goes deeper to that, which is this being used? Is the reason one might ask an ESTA traveler for a social media handler because one wants to ferret out threats, unlawful activity might engage in on U.S. soil? In which case, I think any of us who've worked in national security within the balance of the law want the information that can vet and screen and keep Americans safe while keeping border those crossing the border who have reason to do so. Or is it because there's a desire to apply some sort of political or social litmus test to those coming across our border? And the latter is something very different. I don't know enough about this one to have a view on which category it falls into. But to the extent there's some desire to screen out people, not because they're a threat to American communities or a threat to public safety or a threat to law and order, but instead because they hold a view that's somehow seen as unwanted, unaccepted, or disfavored, that's very different.
Before we go, Josh, I'd like to circle back to an issue that a question that I posed to a number of people who have been on the front lines like yourself, who've sat at the table, people who are players in the national security realm. We hear a lot about Chinese, North Korean, Iranian, et cetera, successful attacks on our infrastructure, infiltration of our telecommunications, banks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We don't hear a lot about U.S. methods because the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, they don't publicize what we do to them. In your experience at these high levels, have you gotten a feeling of whether we are fully and appropriately using our own cyber war capabilities, which are vast, the tailored access program at the NSA, for et cetera, where we can get inside their telecommunications, their power grids, and in terms of the pressing issue at this moment, the fentanyl industry. That we can use these tools of intelligence and cyber warfare effectively against them, or are they irrelevant in that realm?
Well, I would not want to call them irrelevant. And as you say, it can be tough to talk about for those of us who've served, and especially when the greatest successes are sometimes the ones not talked about. But I will say this, the part of why you saw in the last year of the previous administration, the Biden administration, a national security memorandum on AI was to try to get the national security parts of our government utilizing within guardrails, within bounds, a technology as transformative as AI, better and faster and more than they were already. That's not to say they weren't putting it to some use already. That would be unfair to them. But I think you saw a push from our White House, and I hope it's a push that has continued under the current administration, which has been very focused on AI in many ways, to use it. Because this is a different sort of transformative technology from nuclear technology or space technology, which were developed by the government or governments and then kind of doled out in heavily regulated ways to the private sector. That's not true of AI. AI was generated essentially by the private sector, primarily the U.S. private sector. And now it's a question of what do you do if you're in the government? Our view was we don't recreate it. We were never going to catch up if we tried to develop our own large.
Did you employ it? Did you use AI in the area of drug interdiction and so on?
And that's what you see in the National Security Memorandum from the final year of the Biden administration. Now, part of that document's classified, but a lot of it's public. And it was centered around very particular pilot projects for the intelligence community, military, for the Treasury Department, to do at least the type of thing you're saying, Jeff, which is to say, how do we take this, bring a commercially available model into the U.S. government, whether supplementing it with law enforcement information or conceivably even classified information, and then putting it to use to keep Americans safe while guarding against it, doing things we wouldn't want it to do, like yielding some sort of output that one uses quite serious and consequential national security is based on, only to realize it was wrong, because it still can be wrong. That was a major focus for us. I do think it led to some innovation, and I kind of hope that innovation is continuing, both on the get in the game and use this stuff better, faster, more, but also on the guardrail side, so you don't look back and regret.
I got one last question for you, Josh. I don't know if you've had a chance to see the film A House of Dynamite about the nuclear missile headed towards
good,
the United States.
But
in the latter part of the film, the National Security Staff reverts to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, which is the underground bunker where you're supposed to go if there's a threat to the White House. Now, as we have been pointing out for the last month on this show, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the bunker, is located underneath the East Wing, which has just been destroyed by this White House. So is the bunker still there? Did you have to get there through the East Wing? Is there another way to get there? What can you tell us on this pressing issue?
Well, now you've given me something else to worry about, Mike. I don't know the answer, but now you've added to my list of...
That's the answer we've been getting from everybody. Nobody knows.
But I'm glad you were able to ask that question without a spoiler in it, because I'm keen to see the film. And I've heard from former colleagues, including those who worked in and with the Situation Room closely, that it's a pretty good conjuring of what it's like by the remarkable public servants who serve in that space in particular. So I'm still keen to
watch.
Well,
after seeing it, if you could shed any light on this issue that we've been fixated on, please
let us
know. Where's
the bunker?
Where is the bunker? And how do you get there?
Are there signs?
Wait, were you in it? Were you ever in it, Josh?
No, thankfully. That's a good thing.
All right, Josh, Okay. Thanks so much for spending some of your very valuable time with us. We're honored by your presence, and thanks a lot.
This was a great conversation. Thanks for the help.
Thanks, Josh.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk. You'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.